May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gordon Vaughn. I represent Officer Jeffrey Martinez in the lawsuit brought in state court by Stephen Bleck against Officer Martinez. This case arises out of an August 6, 2010 incident in Alamosa, in which Officer Martinez, along with several other officers, responded to the local motel because a mental health worker had contacted 911 and reported that they had received a call from Mr. Bleck, who had reported that he was suicidal, he was believed to be intoxicated, he had threatened to blow his brains out, he was reported as possibly armed, and the officers went into the hotel room unannounced in order to be able to take protective custody of Mr. Bleck to prevent him from committing suicide or doing harm. In the course of that entry, Officer Martinez, who was in the lead, had his Glock service revolver drawn, as would be the case in any such dynamic entry into a room under such circumstances with a potentially armed individual threatening to do harm, in ready position. Mr. Bleck was sitting on the bed with his back to the officers, did not respond to showing his hands. When Officer Martinez got close enough, he went to push Mr. Bleck to the bed to take control of him. In doing so, he still had his Glock in his hand, and as he was pushing him down towards the bed, the Glock accidentally discharged, striking Mr. Bleck in the hip. There is absolutely no dispute. In fact, if you read the response brief of Mr. Bleck, it's agreed that the discharge of the firearm was accidental. The question then before this court is, can an accidental discharge of a firearm, an undisputed accidental discharge of a firearm, rise to the level of a battery, particularly in the context of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act and the immunity provisions afforded to governmental employees under that act? Now, in addressing this issue, there's five fundamental legal concepts that I wish to point out, because I think that Judge Swift, the district court judge in this case, made error as to two of those fundamental legal premises. Those five legal premises are as follows. Number one, there is no exception to immunity under 2410.106 for battery by a police officer. None of the exceptions set out there are present. The second legal concept is this, that the only way that one can get to a tort remedy under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act against an individual officer is pursuant to 2410.118 and the willful and wanton conduct exception set out therein, that exception stating generally that conduct of an employee of a public entity is subject to the same immunity provisions of 2410.106, save for if that person's conduct is willful and wanton. The third concept is relating to the issue of battery and what the elements are of battery. The elements of battery are, number one, that there has to have been physical contact. Two, that physical contact is physical contact that was intended by the defendant. And third, that physical contact had to be intended to be harmful or offensive. Now, in the context of a governmental claim, that against a governmental employee, you have to superimpose the willful and wanton component of 2410.118 over the top of the battery claim. So the second and third elements of this particular claim should then read number two element, that there has to be willful and wanton contact with the plaintiff, and two, that there has to be willful and wanton intent for that conduct to have that contact to have been harmful or offensive. The last legal concept that I would point out is there is a concept of unintended injury that is superimposed on a tort of battery. That is that if, for example, I take a water balloon and in fun try to throw it at someone and it hits their eye and causes significant injury to the eye, although I did not intend that injury, it is assumed that I am responsible for that injury because the offensive conduct of throwing a water balloon and hitting him in the face subsumes unintended injury. The concept of unintended injury does not include an unintended act that's superimposed over a battery claim. In other words, if I take that water balloon and I throw it and hit the person, while I might be responsible for unintended injury, if in retreating from having thrown the water balloon, I run into a ladder and the ladder is knocked down and falls and hits the person, that's an unintentional act. That unintentional act, while it could be alleged to be negligent, cannot be part of a battery claim. I believe these are fundamental concepts of tort law as particularly applied to claims under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act.
Counsel, I appreciate that. I'm concerned about whether or not we have jurisdiction to hear your appeal. Could you address that issue, please?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll go back to the errors after I hit the interlocutory appeal issue. What I believe you're referring to, Judge Miller, is the concept of interlocutory appeals that relates to claims under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. The Brace versus City of Lakewood case says that a claim against an individual for willful and wanton conduct where there are disputed issues of fact has to await trial, and that that is not interlocutory. What Brace says, however, and what all of the cases, and we cite a number of those cases, particularly at, I believe, pages, I think it starts at 6 of our reply brief for about 3 pages. One of them is the Ute Mountain Tribe case. But the concept is that if it's not a disputed issue of fact, it then becomes a final order, and it then is interlocutorily appealable. And the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, as we set out in the brief, specifically sets out that claims against individuals are final and interlocutory. And the whole Brace concept is talking about that there's fact issues that ultimately affect the willful and wanton component. And our proposition here, Judge Miller, is that when it is undisputed that the discharge of the firearm was accidental, that's the driving fact that takes this out of the concept that there is disputed issues of fact, and this is that circumstances in which you have jurisdiction to be able to consider this case.
Mr. Vaughn, does any of the cases that you cited hold that or involve disputed facts and conclude that because there were disputed facts that an issue of what would otherwise be qualified immunity is changed into an issue of sovereign immunity?
First of all, just let me say, the concept of sovereign immunity and qualified immunity is never a term used in the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act.
It was used by the Supreme Court in the Brace case, was it not?
It is, and I agree with that. And when they refer to the qualified immunity, the qualified concept is that you're qualified in getting all the immunities under 2410-106 so long as you didn't act willfully and wantonly. And if there is a disputed issue of fact of willful and wanton, I agree that Brace says that you don't have jurisdiction. What Brace says, and what all the cases have talked about Brace, if you, for example, go to the Ute Mountain Tribe case, in which that, although that involved tribal immunity, they then took on Brace, and they used the Brace concept, and they said, as long as there's not a disputed issue of fact, it is a final order, and it is immediately interlocutorily appealable.
With all due respect, Mr. Vaughn, I'm not sure that you've answered my question. I just want to know if any of the cases that have relied on and cited Brace have expressly involved disputed issues of fact, so that the court held because there are disputed issues of fact, we consider this to be a question of sovereign immunity rather than qualified immunity.
The answer to that, as I understand the question, is no. There's not any case that the court has taken on in which there's a disputed issue of fact and allowed it to be an interlocutory appeal. I'll give you an example. The Carruthers case involving a case that I was involved in, a dog bite case in which an officer alleged to have intentionally not responded, even though knowing there was dangerous dogs in the vicinity of children. In that particular case, the court said that it was not interlocutory appealable because the question of the conduct of the officer in not responding was a disputed issue of fact, and so therefore it was not interlocutorily appealable. That was the case that I had before this court. So I think the answer to that is I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. But what I am aware of is that which I explained to Judge Miller, and that is that we are in a situation in which it is a clear, undisputed fact that it was an unintentional discharge of the firearm.
Counsel, but didn't the, excuse me, did the trial court not conclude that there were disputed issues of fact?
No, sir, not on the accidental. The court actually said that it's undisputed that it's an accidental discharge. What the court, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What I believe you might be referring to is there was some question as to what the training was as to whether you should holster the gun and those sorts of things. Those are not the material fact. The material fact is that it was an accidental discharge, and the accidental discharge, taking you back to those concepts that I was talking about, cannot be. It's that act which has to be the driving force for the actual assault, I mean, the battery. And so what the court's error was here is the court said the battery is pushing him down. And that transfers the issue of whether, that's transferring the act. That's the last, he's now saying, well, you know, that's the pushing him down is the water balloon. The gun going off is totally accidental. That's the situation of the ladder falling out. Let me put it this way. Let's say that he didn't touch him. Let's say that the officer did not push down Mr. Blake, and he's holding his firearm, and it actually discharges and shoots him. Would any of us argue that as long as it's undisputed that it's an accidental discharge, would any of us argue that that's a battery? I don't think so. And the only way that the court could, Judge Swift, could take the battery and superimpose it in is by saying, well, you did touch him, and you intentionally touched him. And that's transferring the act. There's all sorts of intentional acts that lead to negligence. I cite a Law Review article from Temple Law Review that talks about the concept of intentional conduct as it relates to battery. You can, and they use an example of a vehicle that's traveling, that you intentionally get in the vehicle, you're intentionally driving, you may intentionally get on the cell phone, and you may unintentionally be running to someone. It may be negligent, but it's not battery under those circumstances. The same situation is under the circumstances here is you can't superimpose the act of pushing down onto the accidental discharge of the firearm. Your Honors, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
I do have one quick question. Time. Can you clarify for me, because I'm looking at this language in Brace, that says a willful and wanton determination potentially requires weighing of testimony and evidence, functions which are in the province of the jury or trier of fact and not the trial court. And so a well-pled claim that an employee acted willfully and wantonly must await determination at trial on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor. And if you go on Brace, it also says that if there is undisputed, that's a situation in which there's disputed issues of fact. Mm-hmm. It expressly says that. And if you look at the Ute Mountain Tribe, it goes to that specific language and it says, but if the driving facts are undisputed, if the material facts are undisputed, that's a different situation. I agree with your language reading that, but once there's undisputed facts, there is no longer the qualified immunity concept that Brace was trying to protect. The Ute Mountain Tribe was a case in which dismissal was denied, and it came up, and this court said that, yes, it's still interlocutory under those circumstances because we're not dealing with disputed issues of fact.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Maren Johnson. I represent Plaintiff Appellee Estate of Stephen Bleck. I think the first and most important issue is whether or not this court actually has jurisdiction to even hear this claim. As set forth in our briefing and also in the Brace matter, this is not a jurisdictional issue. As Mr. Vaughn admitted to the court, there is no Colorado case law in which where you have disputed issues of material fact that it becomes an issue of sovereign immunity. Rather, it is qualified immunity, which works as an affirmative defense. So on the outset, the court does not even have jurisdiction to hear this. It's not right for interlocutory appeal. There are disputed issues of material fact in this case, and what we have to look at is not just the actual pulling of the trigger. We have to look at the entire series of events put into place intentionally, volitionally, and deliberately by Defendant Martinez. As pled in plaintiff's complaint, we know that Defendant Martinez had done prior training with the Department of Alamosa. He was aware that the standards of Alamosa is that he was not supposed to go hands-on with a deadly force weapon. Also, as pled in plaintiff's complaint and admitted by Defendant Martinez in his deposition in the federal court case, he was aware of the likelihood when you have a deadly force weapon in one hand and you are doing actions with your other non-dominant hand, there is a strong likelihood that that can result in the weapon discharging, which is exactly what happened here.
Ms. Johnson, on what basis are you saying that there are disputed issues of fact in this case? Because I assume that no answer was filed.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, we know from the other, from the motion to dismiss, that there are disputed issues here of exactly what happened. The one issue that's not disputed, as Mr. Vaughn pointed out, is that Defendant Martinez does not admit to actually having the intent to pull the trigger.
But I'm just wondering how logically a motion to dismiss can create disputed issues of fact.
Well, Your Honor, in any case, when there's a motion to dismiss, the no answer filed, there can still be genuine issues of material fact that are disputed. Again, here it's the actual intent that nobody can know, but those are facts for the jury to determine in any case of what Defendant Martinez's actual subjective intent was in going into that room and the entire series of events. Again, that's an issue for the jury to decide.
Well, no, I don't dispute that that's normally a jury question, but when there's a motion to dismiss under 12b-5, normally all of the allegations of the complaint are accepted as true. And if there is a sovereign immunity question, any factual disputes would be resolved at a hearing based on 12b-1.
That's correct, Your Honor. And here they did not, the defendant did not bring up a 12b-1 sovereign immunity issue with the lower court. That was just raised in their briefing with the Court of Appeals. Again, where there is a determination that needs to be made whether or not there was willful or wanton conduct, then that would be a 12b-5 motion. And again, that was a motion that was actually filed by defendants in this case with the lower court. And so we have to look at all the issues that remain and that are genuine issues of material fact. It's not appropriate to say that the only issue here is if Defendant Martinez intended to actually pull the trigger. Again, we know that he intended to go into a room based on Defendant Martinez's own testimony with the deadly force weapon drawn. Despite the fact that Mr. Black did not move, he wasn't resisting, he moved and went hands-on with the gun in his hand. He used that hand to secure Mr. Black's wrist. We also know that there is no actual safety on the Glock. The safety mechanism is only if you accidentally drop it, it won't discharge. But when you pull the trigger, there is no safety mechanism. And so those are the issues of genuine issues of material fact that are remaining that the court needs to consider. And those should be viewed in light most favorable to the plaintiff in this case. As the lower court pointed out, it's also recognized in the Colorado Civil Jury Instruction and the White versus Nunez case that we have to, again, as Mr. Vaughn pointed out, apply the willful wanton standard to the three elements of battery. However, as defendants have argued in their briefing, they said that there has to be a wanton and willful desired harmful consequence. Willful and wanton, as the lower court pointed out and is in the case law, that's conduct that is purposely committed, that the actor realized was dangerous and was done heedlessly or recklessly without regard for consequences or safety of others, particularly plaintiff. That's not saying that there has to be a desired harmful outcome, rather they disregarded the safety or the consequences of their actions. Again, here we have to look at the disputed issues of material fact in that defendant Martinez has admitted that he was aware, based on his training, that using a deadly force weapon at the same time as going hands-on has a strong likelihood of resulting in discharge of that weapon. And that's the entire sequence of events that was put into place. And as we filed some supplemental authority from the 10th Circuit, when they looked at whether or not there was a seizure, they also looked at the entire circumstances of what happened, not just the actual pulling of the trigger. And so that, again, is what the court needs to consider in determining whether or not there was actually willful or wanton conduct. And so applying that to the elements of battery, number one, that defendant intended to physically touch plaintiff or go hands-on, plaintiff has alleged that in its complaint that there was, in fact, physical touching of plaintiff. And the lower court decided that there was as well, and that, of course, was the act of going hands-on with Mr. Black, which was an intended action by defendant Martinez. And then we have to look at whether the conduct was offensive, as pointing out with the court in the White versus Nunes case. If the actor of an average intelligence performs an act, and the jury can decide that the actor has the requisite intent to cause that harmful conduct, then that element is met. And again, here we know that Mr. Defendant Martinez was aware that this could result in harmful contact. It's not a situation like Mr. Vaughn just posed, that he went into the room and had a gun and it accidentally discharged before he even approached Mr. Black. We have a circumstance where he deliberately and intentionally approached Mr. Black with a deadly force weapon drawn, went hands-on with Mr. Black, grabbed his wrist with the weapon poised in his hand with his finger near the trigger. So again, defendant Martinez had the requisite intent to know that he could have caused harmful contact. And again, that's an issue for the jury to determine. One can't know defendant Martinez's actual subjective intent, and that's why the facts need to be presented to a jury in order for them to determine whether or not he had that requisite intent. And then,
go ahead. No, you go.
Okay. Well, I believe that Mr. Vaughn, in his briefing, was saying that such conduct by a police officer affected on an arrestee is privileged, and therefore it could not be offensive. And I just wanted to hear your response to that.
Yes, Your Honor. As we pointed out in our response briefing, doesn't allow for an officer to use excessive force. And so I think that is the most important factor to look at here. While, yes, an officer is authorized to go hands-on in situations where they need to, that doesn't authorize them to violate Mr. Black's rights and to use excessive force. Again, we know that he went hands-on with a deadly force weapon in place, despite the fact that Mr. Black was not resisting arrest in any manner and was simply sitting on the bed in the room. We also know from the federal court case that there are international standards for dealing with mentally ill, and from the depositions of the actual mental health professionals involved, that the best way to approach a mentally ill individual is not to go hands-on with a deadly force weapon. And so simply because an officer is, yes, permitted to come into contact and physically contact individuals where they are doing a welfare check, that does not permit them to use excessive force, which is what happened here.
Ms. Johnson, you mentioned that the defendant did not raise 12B1 in the trial court. The motion, I have the motion in front of me, says the defendant's motion to dismiss under CRCP 12B1 and 12B5. And I think the motion specifically says that one of the arguments, argument one, that he is immune under the CGIA from Black's claim of battery, is asserted under 12B1. So did the defendant request a hearing on the motion, an evidentiary hearing on the motion?
No, Your Honor. There was no evidentiary hearing for the lower court. And again, with the 12B1, CRS 2410105 specifically waives immunity for public employees acting within the course and scope of employment when the plaintiff alleges in the complaint acts or omissions that were willful and wanton by the public employee, which was the case here. And again, that's why 12b1 is not applicable, and there is no sovereign immunity that needs to be addressed, whether it's qualified immunity as set forth in the Brace case, which again, we have to look at as not the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals. It's not right for interlocutory appeal. Rather, it is an affirmative defense, and that's issues for the jury to decide. So even if we apply the definition of willful and wanton, and that is set forth in the Moody case that we addressed in our briefing, and again, willful and wanton is actions that are done recklessly without due regard to the consequences that could be caused. Even applying that to the elements of battery, there are clearly genuine issues of material fact that remain, and it's been pled in his complaint that there was willful and wanton conduct. And conduct by Kenneth Martinez. And again, we can't just look at the one act that defendant would like us to look at, which is the pulling of the trigger, but it's the entire series of events that was set into motion deliberately, intentionally, by defendant Martinez. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Now you have 52 seconds remaining.
We did not ask for a hearing. We accept the findings of the court that it was unintentional. That was the plea, and it's unintentional. In the response brief, it's an unintentional discharge of a firearm. This case has real consequences. Is an officer not immune when he goes in to try and rescue someone, putting his own life in danger, and is trying to push the person down to take control of him, and the firearm accidentally discharges? If he's acting willfully and wantonly, he's not covered. They don't have to indemnify him under the 2410.110.1. No indemnity for willful and wanton conduct. Pretty good chance that most public employees, not just cops, doctors, anyone who's acting, if there can just simply be somebody say you acted willfully and wantonly, and you acted intentionally all the way up to the point until there was an unintentional act, if that's the case, we have a problem with what we're doing for our public employees. This has real consequences. Here,
okay,
the
thank
firearm
you. Thank
was
you.
The discharge that caused the injury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. And the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.